session number 16355, Reel 2.
Mr. Ames, Reel 2.
We were surprised to hear the pilots, the wireless operator saying that he'd sunk the yacht. Well, what had happened? The torpedo had porpoised. It had hit the wave tops, and instead of going underneath the yacht, it had actually jumped and gone into and burst open the side of the yacht to such a degree that it took up so much water that it actually capsized. It literally had sunk. That, of course, was not on the calendar. And I'm afraid the commanding officer of the station was not very pleased. It was an expenditure that he could quite well have done without. Still, those things do happen. Condor at that time was in the state of being constructed. Even though there was the hard runway, the living quarters for the people who were there were more or less swamps. And because we were living in confined quarters, there was an epidemic of cerebrospinal meningitis, which was not very nice. There were actually 40 of us who went down with it. And of that 40, only 2 of us survived. I had this complaint, but I was lucky in as much as I was celibate and teetotal at the time, and my health was rather robust, and I was able to shake it off because one of the concoctions that they were dealing out to us was an experimental powder, one of Gray's powders, M&B's powders, not Gray's, and it was mixed with whiskey. And the fact was that I was teetotal, the combination of the whiskey and the powder seemed to turn the tide as far as I was concerned. But unfortunately, I lost my eyesight. I went blind. This, luckily, was only a temporary thing, but it made me unfit for duty temporarily, and I was given leave to go home. Well, home in those days was where my wife was living, and she was down at Leamington Spa. She came up to Leamington, and she came up to Arbroath and stayed with the Coast Guards at the Wee Touri on the Coast Guard station until I was in a fit condition to move, and then we went down to Leamington. And when we came back after she'd nursed me, the first thing I had to do was to obey orders like everybody, and the first order I got was report to the station commander's office. And what on earth have I done now? I haven't been in the camp long enough to commit a crime. He saw me and he said, "What on earth are you doing here? You're supposed to be dead." And then he told me about the other 38 chaps who had turned their toes up. It made me feel thankful that I had been teetotal.
Was there anything about conditions in the camp that should have caused it?
It was a camp which was virtually a swamp. The living area was constantly underwater, and it was winter time, and there was more people in the camp than would normally be accepted because drafts were coming in to build up the camp, and of course the workmen were working as fast as they could, but conditions were not conducive to healthy living. Food and drink and all that was, you know, perfect. You couldn't grumble at that. It's just the fact that, well, somebody had got the bug, and that was it. Whether the bug had been brought in from outside, I don't know. But we did have some very, very limited social life, and one very black spot was the fact that one of our draft, he'd been socialising outside with a very pretty young lady. She was the daughter of the local vicar. But unfortunately, when he went back to his billets one night, he found himself in an uncomfortable state. He went to the MO and explained his condition. The MO told him he'd got BD, and him being a virgin until he'd gone out with the vicar's daughter was rather upset. He promptly came back and shot himself, which rather put a blanket of despair on our draft. Now, where did we go from there? Oh, yes. We had to go back to Leon Solans for a short time, and then we were sent out to join the Argus, the aircraft carrier. It was time to really work. This was 1941. We joined the Argus, and our job at that time was to take aircraft from England to Gibraltar. You've probably heard the expression a club run. Well, that is what we were doing. We were doing a regular trip, so regular that we'd almost dug a groove into the waterway. I was not attached to a squadron at the time. I was attached to the ship's company as aircraft handling party. We took on the aircraft in England, lifted them on by crane onto the Argus, packed them down into the lower deck with their wings folded, and then went out to jib and did the whole thing in reverse. Took them from the lower deck onto the flight deck, took them to the crane, and then manhandled them over the side. Memories of the Argus. Well, she was a chunky little ship, almost box-like, and that's where she got her nickname from, the Ditty Box. It was just like a huge Ditty Box floating on the top of the water. Canteen messing on there, that was really fun. That was where the individual mess could have been anything from a dozen to 40 people, had to cater for themselves. They were allowed a certain amount of cash that they could spend, but that cash was to be spent inside the ship, and it was all on paper. It wasn't actually money that changed hands. They drew their stores from the pusser's mess and did their own catering, feeding each other. If you lived half the hog and spent more than your allowance, it was docked off your pay. If you was more frugal and you saved a little bit, then you got that back as a bonus on payday. Some of the chaps who'd been mother's boys and never even boiled an egg before they came on board the ship were introduced to this type of catering. One of the most popular things was what was known as a pound cake. A pound cake consisted of a pound of everything. It didn't matter what it was. A pound of flour, a pound of sugar, a pound of currants, a pound of rice, a pound of anything that was edible, it went in. And it was mixed to a dropping consistency with watered down evaporated milk, put into a big greased dish, and that was your pound cake. One thing had to be specifically insisted on was the fact that a large potato, a peeled potato, was stuck in the top of it. This was taken to the ship's cook, and if the potato was stuck in the top, it used to go into a steam oven, and it used to come out as a steamed pudding when the potato was cooked and steamed. If the potato was missing, it used to go into a dry oven and come out as a cake. All the same mix, but we used to enjoy it. And the number of cockroaches that went into it was beyond belief. But we used to say, what doesn't fatten will fill. Now, this was a great thing to do until some wag, either deliberately or by accident, made a mistake. And he also included a pound of yeast. And that was fatal. The poor cooks didn't know what the dickens had hit them when they opened their ovens and found their ovens were chock-a-block full of pound cake. I'm afraid we were not in the best of books with the cooks after that. We had to make sure that that kind of thing didn't happen again.
When was your run to Gibraltar, do you know?
That was 1941. On one of these trips to Gibraltar, we were told that a number of us would be transferred on. We would not be coming back to England. We would be going further afield, and we didn't know where, why, or what. But that was it. Get your kit ready, you're going from Gibraltar. We were put on a small coaster and just hope for the best. We eventually finished up in Port Said. Oh, what are we doing here? Oh, you'll find out. Anyway, we was at the coaling wharf there, and one of the old shellbacks came up to me and said, here's your first lesson in culture shock. Watch that train across there. That train actually was a train of people going up a gangway from a coaling wharf to a small freighter, each of them carrying a small bag or a small satchel of coal on their shoulder, going up the ramp, tipping the coal into the hatch and coming down the other way. So that one, the one with the red headband, watch him. Okay, we watched him, got up onto the deck of the freighter and disappeared among the deck cargo. Immediately he disappeared, another one of the train disappeared with him. He said, right, now time him. And we timed him 7 minutes, then he was back into the stream. He said he will have earned more in that 7 minutes than he could possibly have earned in a month heaving coal. I'll leave you to imagine what the activities were in among the deck cargo. That was our first culture shock.
What do you think he was taking?
Well, it was obviously one of these, what we used to call at the time, fairies. He went up and disappeared, and another one went behind with him and indulged in a little bit of carnal knowledge. It was not an unusual practice, apparently, among those type of people. Anyway, we were transferred out of that ship onto dockside and put in open trucks, open-topped trucks, and taken out through the desert. And we finished up at a place called Faid, on the banks of the Bitter Lake. Okay, we still don't know what we're doing here. We eventually found out that we were supposed to be going out as relief crew to the Hermes, the seaplane carrier. But the Hermes had been sunk by the Japanese in the Indian Ocean. So they had to find us an alternative place to dump us. Dump being the literal word. We were dumped in Faid, which was an RAF station, staging post. And they were working at the time with Stirling bombers. And they were transferring and converting from Stirlings to Liberators, big four engine machines, as you know. And the Fleet Air Arm, oh, thank goodness you've come, we can do with you, spare hands, do all the rough work. So we literally was thrown at the deep end there, doing all the humping. Now, in Faid, there was a real class distinction act there. They were the lowest of the low, who were the Africans, who were doing the heavy work. There were the Egyptians who were working as overseers. There was the lower deck men like us. And then there was the officer class. Well, the officer class were a class on their own. We kept away from them as much as possible. We didn't want to know them, they didn't want to know us. We worked with the RAF chaps. The Egyptians, the overseers, they used to walk around with bullwhips, and they used to use them on the Africans. It's just like going back 2,000 years to the days when they were building the pyramids. The Egyptians and the Africans were not allowed to come into the working area where there was any aircraft. They were segregated, but they were doing the humping, all the heavy work when stuff was unloaded. Anyway, our particular draft, the Fleet Air Arm draft, strangely enough, we built up an affinity with some of the Africans, and we could stomach them more than we could appreciate the Egyptians. And one night, to our amazement, one of them made known by broken English and sign language that we were invited to go to one of their parties, one of their festivals. Well, we'd never experienced anything like this before, so we made inquiries among the RAF chaps, is this all right to mix in this way socially with them? And one of the old shellbacks who had been there for a long, long time said, yeah, but I'll come with you, keep you on the right track. Said, accept the invitation, don't upset them, accept everything in moderation, but when I give you the word, get out of there as fast as you can. Okay, great. So we went in, and it was just like something out of Rider Haggard. They had their own compounds, their own campfires, those spitty ducks and the chickens, you know, roasting on spits, and goat's meat and all the rest of it, and strange brews that they were drinking, feathered headdress and coloured outfits. The African women there with their calico and, you know, brightly coloured dresses. And it was really a wonderful time. We were really enjoying things. And then the RAF chap said, right, now's the time to move. And it was just beginning to warm up. It was just beginning to get into the swing of things. And see, it was just like something out of books that you read. Okay, we'll take your advice, and we gradually slipped away into the darkness. Said, what was the idea? Things were just beginning to warm up then. Said, we were enjoying the meat and the drink that we was getting. None of us was really drunk. We was enjoying the food. Said, everybody was enjoying themselves. Why pull us out just now? Well, he said, I noticed that one or two of the younger people had disappeared into the darkness. And I also noticed that the older men were beginning to get a little bit tight on the local hooch that they were drinking. And in view of the fact that this was a fertility festival, I decided it was time I pulled you out before they got you. We then knew what we was almost let ourselves in for. It was quite a night to remember. We stayed there for some time, and eventually somebody remembered that we were there. And we were sent to a place called Tewfik, which is on the southern edge of the Red Sea, in open trucks again. And we piled on board prize of war ship. It was a French ship that had been captured, the Ile de France. It must have been one of the most dirty, filthy ships that had ever been built. By the time we came up through the Red Sea, through the Suez, and got back to Malta, we had to make an emergency stop, because half the crew were flat on their backs. The rest of them, and every passenger on the ship, was either sick with food poisoning or dysentery. For everybody from the captain down to the ship's cat was really bad. Even the rats was jumping overboard as soon as we got into quiet water. Well, we were isolated with the ship. It wasn't allowed to come into the harbour itself, it was isolated outside. But we were taken off, and our draft was sent to the RAF station at Halfar to recover. That night, every lavatory in the station was filled to capacity, and quite a lot of us didn't even make it to the lavatory. We just huddled the best way we could between the huts. And I understand that in the 48 hours following, there was more disinfectant used in that camp than being used in the 6 years previously. That was a really night to remember.
Why should it have been so filthy?
Well, we don't know. We don't know what conditions existed before it was captured. But the crew that was on it, half of them were Lascars, and the other half, well, I don't know what nationality it was, but it really was a horrible place. It was like a floating dungeon. I think the kindest thing that ought to have been done to it was to left it where it was in the Indian Ocean or wherever it came from and put a bomb in it. It would have been more healthy for everybody concerned. Anyway, we eventually got back to England, and I wasn't at home long before somebody said, you're on draft again. Oh yeah, where are we going this time? Well, you've got a PO taking you up. He's going up to HMS Eagle. Where on earth is HMS Eagle? What is HMS Eagle? Oh, you'll find out when you get there. Well, the petty officer, he was laughing all over his face. He was really chuffed to little mint balls. He got his wires crossed. And instead of taking us to the aircraft carrier Eagle, he took us to HMS Eaglet, which is the Navy Reserve Depot on Merseyside, which is manned by Wrens. Well, he thought he was going to live out his war in luxury. If every man's hopes were dashed, he was that man. We presented ourselves at HMS Eaglet, and the officer on the gate, well, he promptly turned us away. You can't come in here, there's all Wrens, we've got no facility for you lot in here, so go and find out where you can billet yourself. They got hold of the regulating petty officer of the transport section, and they read it through. Well, you've come to the wrong place entirely, you want to be up at Birkenhead. So that's where we eventually clued up, at Birkenhead. In Birkenhead we found the Eagle. She was undergoing a massive refit. She had come from the Mediterranean, but we eventually found out that she would be going back to the Mediterranean. All her light armament had been stripped out of her. The .5 machine guns had been stripped out and Oikens fitted. Pom-poms had been put on the deck. The 6-inch and 4-inch guns were still available, still left there. She could actually be fought as a cruiser if things came to a pinch. You know, as a 6-inch cruiser, she had so many 6-inch guns on her. The fire director was moved. Extra radar was fitted. The oil tanks, the fuel oil tanks, were reduced considerably, and in their place there was aviation fuel tanks fitted. So something queer was going on altogether. In fact, the ship, in round figures, she gained 5,000 tons in dead weight with the extra stuff that had been put on, armaments and various other fittings. But for operational purposes, she lost a fifth of her speed and a fifth of our operational radius. So we knew that instead of being a high speed hunter as she had been, she was obviously being fitted out as a short term, short radius, hard hitting weapon of some type. Well, that turned out to be convoy defence. She could do 20 knots. Most high speed convoys at that time were around about 16 knots. Well, we knew where we were going, lower deck men. We knew a fortnight before we sailed where we were going, even though they had tried to baffle us with saying, oh yes, the Russians are here, they've got snow on the boats and all the rest of it, and they're coming with us. The officers, I don't know whether they knew or not, because they're living in a world of their own. It was a case of what, where, when and who with them. They were, well, they lived on this planet, but they didn't live in this world as far as we was concerned. But even 2 weeks before we sailed, we knew which convoy we was going with. We knew the number of the convoy we was going with. We knew where we were going. I think the Russians, the French, the Germans, the Spanish and everybody else knew. Even the ship's cat knew where we were going. But anyway, the day came and we sailed with convoy WS-16. It was as protection to the convoy, and we were carrying aircraft, of course. Now, these aircraft were Spitfires. And they'd had to be loaded onto the carrier Eagle by lift, crane. They were hoisted on individually and then manhandled to the forward lift, because the forward lift was the only lift available on any British carrier, not just on the Eagle. The forward lift was the only lift available that would take an aircraft with its wings spread out. Most other aircraft that had been on carriers had folding wings, but the Spitfires didn't. They were fixed wing type. But the configuration of the fixed of the forward lift on the Eagle was T-shaped, and the Spitfires could be lowered down. But of course, because they were fixed wing, we couldn't carry a lot of aircraft. We had four Hurricanes that were on deck. They were for ship's defence. They were moored aft of the superstructure, leaving the round down and the flight deck clear. Well, eventually we got to Gibraltar, and we were detached from that convoy and joined Force H to replace the Ark Royal, which had been sunk. We then realised that our job was to supply the island of Malta with aircraft. And in the first month that we was there, the month of March, we did three trips up the Mediterranean. Each trip was a full-blown naval operation. The battleships, cruisers, destroyers, submarines, real big escorts to take us down.
Was this March 42?
March 42. We did three trips. And each of those three trips, we got to within 500 miles of Malta, flew off the aircraft, and then we turned back. The aircraft themselves made the last little bit themselves. But each of those three trips was in itself a naval battle, because we were up against the might of the Italian Navy and the German Flieger Corps. Now, by the time we'd done the third one, the Eagle was so battered around with concussions underwater, with bomb explosions and high-speed manoeuvring, that she literally was unseaworthy. McIntosh,